Welcome to the podcast that keeps the clocks running on time. You're listening to Art House Legends, where high art and geek culture collide. I'm the movie dude, Eric.
And I'm Chris Tondable.
And on this episode, we're discussing 1946's The Stranger, starring Edward G. Robinson, Orson Welles, Loretta Young, and directed by Orson Welles. Now, I don't know about you, but I am a pretty big fan of Orson Welles' work. Out of curiosity, how familiar are you with Orson Welles?
Just the classics. You had the Citizen Kane in there. I went to a couple film classes when I was in community college, and that was really about all my exposure to him. I know that he's also famous for ruining commercials, which is fun. Mm-hmm. Just because he drinks quite a bit and drinks the product. So that's basic knowledge of it. So not too much.
All right. So out of curiosity, have you seen Citizen Kane?
Yeah. I've seen that a few handful of times.
Okay. So what was your impression of Citizen Kane?
The camera work and the lighting has been something that's always stuck with me. I really like all the different shots that are in there, and the fact that was really one of the first ones, and they were doing so many different techniques that still permeate throughout the film culture. I really liked it. The acting, when you look back at some of the old school acting, it is a little hammy. And that's kind of how I felt watching this movie, The Stranger. But I really enjoyed Citizen Kane. I love I think the black and white and the play with shadows and light and the different angles that they can cut through, which I think came out with this film too, does a really, really good job. And I love the style and the look of it. The acting I can go either way with.
Now, I've made it no secret that I love Citizen Kane. When we did our episode on Citizen Kane, probably, I think it was back in season 2 of Art House Legends. Wow, I can't believe how long it has been since then. but I've seen quite a bit of Orson Welles' filmography, including last year, almost 2 years ago, when Orson Welles' long-lost film, The Other Side of the Wind, came out onto Netflix, and I was even impressed with that film.
That one was incomplete, wasn't it?
It was incomplete. It was done by, or it was completed by Peter Bogdanovich, who was mm-hmm. Orson Welles' protege, who Bogdanovich was actually an actor in that film. I don't want to spend too much time on it because I have a feeling that at some point I do want to talk about this with the podcast, but the process was amazing, and the thing is it's so experimental. It does not feel like an Orson Welles film, but then I go back through every other film that Orson Welles has done, and not one of them feels the same as the other, yet they still kind of have an essence that comes from having an auteur such as Orson Welles. And so this was actually one of the very few of his movies that are out where you can watch it that I have not seen. I have not seen The Stranger prior to this particular episode. And so I knew what the premise was. I knew that he has tackled movies that have dealt with some very awkward situations. But if you were to ask me, without me knowing that this is an Orson Welles film, off of what the premise was, I would have said that this would have been an Alfred Hitchcock film. Easy.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
And in a way, you could say that Alfred Hitchcock took this same type of premise with one of his films, well, one of his most well-known films, which was... I say that, and then I completely lose the... Don't you hate it when that happens? Goodness, I'm not going to spend all enough time to... I'll probably just cut this. Anyway, so Orson Welles is taking this film. This is done in 1946. This is just after World War II is over. And in fact, this was a movie that was supposed to have been directed by the great John Huston. John Huston really wanted to do this movie. He was excited to get back into work before work after the after his documentaries with the war. He actually did a cop. He did some script doctoring on the script, and it was all set up for him to go. Except that his time with the military wasn't over, and he was still technically enlisted in the United States Army, if I'm not correct, or the U.S. Navy, doing films for them. So the studio, and specifically producer Sam Spiegel, had to find another director. And so Orson Welles really wanted this movie. And he wanted this movie so badly, everything that he was given in his other films, such as Final Cut, Final Edit, his choice of cast, choice of actors, he lost all of it. He took this basically as a pay-for-play movie. And is it to no one's surprise that this is his least favorite film in his entire filmography?
This is Orson Welles' least favorite film?
Yes. He did not like this film at all. And can we believe that, considering what we know about Orson Welles' ego?
Yeah, I mean, if he doesn't have full control over anything, then yeah, I can definitely understand that this would be his least favorite film all throughout.
And with that said, I will just kind of tip my hand a little bit here. You can still feel the hand of an auteur. And in fact, there are several scenes here where I was really impressed by the way that this film was filmed. But I feel like before we can actually get into the film itself, we need to talk about what kind of movie this is aiming to be. And this is something that when we talk about this movie, I'm going to kind of go back and forth on. Because I feel like there was a movie that Orson Welles wanted this movie to be, and I feel like there was a movie that Sam Spiegel and the studio wanted this to be, and they were not on the same page. Do you kind of get that feeling watching this movie?
It seems like it could have been pushed a little bit more to a psychological thriller. I think that the ways that they made it to where it's almost a propaganda film when you really look at it, because it is that Nazi that's hiding in America, and then they're so bad, and then eventually they get found out, and the climax of it is just, you know, the whole town turns on the Nazi, which is very good. And I'm honestly more surprised that something like this came out so quickly after the war.
I'm actually not. And the reason for that is because the infiltrator plot device that this film uses was something that was already kind of in filmmakers or in audiences' minds, considering, of course, that they had just come out of a war where people of the country, people of the United States, were descendant from the enemy countries. German Americans were considered part of the enemy just because of who they were. Japanese Americans were considered part of the enemy, and in fact were interned because of their because of what people in America thought made them traitors to their country, no matter how much loyalty they showed to the United States. America was extremely paranoid. And it doesn't help that there were films that were coming out that really fed upon it, and that, especially as the Cold War would go on later on, this mentality would actually be capitalized on to the point where by the 1970s, and in fact, you could say all the way up into the 1980s, this paranoia just took over Hollywood when it came to horror and thriller films.
Yeah, I feel like you could actually make this film over and over for every generation because of that kind of idea where you had the World War II, and then you had the Cold War, you had the threat of communism in there, and then you could look at that with everything that we have going on, and that infiltration piece and trying to shape young minds, and the way that this film touches that and presents that into something that really you have to think about, because you're looking at your neighbor at that point being like, who are you really?
Mm-hmm. And I find it very fascinating that this film took the protagonist of this film is Edward G. Robinson. Now, out of curiosity, are you familiar with Edward G. Robinson? Have you ever heard of him before?
I've seen his face, but I don't know really anything else about him.
For me, when it comes to Edward G. Robinson, his most defining characteristic isn't really his face, it's actually his voice. Because, he's the kind of guy that goes after the coppers, is he? I mean, he was Little Caesar. This guy played gangsters. He played criminals. He was well known for it. In fact, so much he was typecasted for a very long time, and in fact would be typecasted as this for much longer. I think it was only like near 1960 when he played another good guy, or semi-good guy, depending, in Double Indemnity, which we've also talked about on this podcast. But yeah, he's always been known for playing gangsters. I mean, he was one of the quintessential. Even now, whenever you think of a role of a old style Chicago gangster, you're either thinking Jimmy Cagney, you're thinking Edward G. Robinson. And so I find it very fascinating that they got this guy that was always known for playing criminals as our hero.
Yeah, you could really picture him with a cigar and just looking intimidating, looking like he's just in the shadows, ready to take over.
Believe it or not, that's the image that people have of him. That is that is actually a common way that people see Edward G. Robinson, and one that he made into a massive career. He was a very famous bad guy when it comes to movies.
I think he does a good job in this, though. I think that he does a really good job because of the nature of the role, where it is kind of that shifty CIA agent, like the undercover agent. I think he does a really good job with pulling it off.
He does. And this is where I'm going to start off where with my conflict between the movie that that Wells is trying to make and the movie that the studio is trying to make. Because what I found out when I was researching for this movie, did you know that 15 minutes of the beginning of the film was removed from the film?
No.
In fact, because it starts off with the former Nazi, the jailed Nazi, being let out.
Yeah.
Basically, he's going to be the worm on the hook to catch a bigger Nazi. But the thing is that entire scene of him getting to that town actually took 15 minutes. And what it did was it showed the exact route that he took to get there, including all the people. We see some of it. The husband and wife investigators, where he kills the wife.
Yeah.
That was actually a bigger role. There was a place where he came across another Nazi. It was extremely exquisite. It honestly, the way that it sounded, and considering how we know well or how much I'm aware of Welles's meticulousness to detail, it felt like he was trying to go for more of a Steven Soderbergh type thing. A kind of not meant to be a good guy and bad guy, polar opposites type thing, but a realistic look at Nazi hunting with a charismatic villain. And he puts himself in that role because he likes to be the most charismatic character in the movie. And so it's fascinating knowing that about this particular movie, because if we had that scene, could you see how it would have changed the dynamic of the film or the way that it would present itself overall if you had the scenes of him and the details of him getting into the United States, getting to this small town in Connecticut?
Yeah, I think that would have been interesting to see how he actually infiltrated everything and started this life, because we only see him when he's fully established as the professor and getting married that same day that the other Nazi comes to the town. I don't know if you need it. And I think one of the things that I like about this movie is that it is very quick and concise. I do like the idea of that build-up, and I do like the idea of seeing everything from start to finish, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure if you need it, because I think that really the hook in there was letting the his lieutenant, I don't remember...
his lieutenant.
Yeah, letting his lieutenant out, and then following that character. I really liked the whole beginning of that, and then that leading us to that quaint little town that looks like there's nothing wrong. There's nothing that's underneath the surface that's kind of ready to sprout up.
And for the most part, I agree with you in the sense that I don't think that it would have worked. Because even though I said that I understand what Welles was going for, one thing that I've watching his filmography that I'm very familiar with when it comes to Orson Welles is that his intention doesn't always mean that that's what the outcome comes out to be. And so I appreciate, and in a way you can definitely sense that approach is something that we're actually going to see done much better in something like Traffic, where Traffic took the concept of being on the, a fly on the wall, watching the big picture type thing. I don't think that this movie could have done it, not with the Hollywood aspects that they put into the film. But that said, though, I find it very fascinating here that Orson Welles went to war with the producer for this, and went to war for the producer when it comes to the other things that he was trying to add more realism to this infiltration. That said, though, when we get into the town, when we set up the pieces, when we find out about Professor Charles as we find out his Nazi name is Franz. That he is infiltrated, that he is a professor at this well-to-do school in this well-to-do town in Connecticut, set up to marry, a prominent figure in this community, basically setting himself up, as he even says himself, for the next war that is going to come.
Yeah, because he's marrying the daughter of a Supreme Court justice. And then his whole idea is to shape the minds of the future leaders of America.
And so it sets all that up really well. I didn't really like kind of how they knocked out the investigator the way it does. Because to me, like, that is the most laziest, quote-unquote, murder scene ever. And just from the way he got hit, in a realistic movie, yes, it would have murdered him. But the way that it's portrayed in the film... It feels like, yeah, he's obviously going to get up. Like,
yeah.
This is, to me, why not check to make sure he's dead? If it's that, if this is that important, just do the groundwork. I mean, come on. I don't know. I mean, but the thing is that there's several times when characters make these very lazy assumptions that they've won or that they've gotten what they wanted. And to me, it's so flimsy, right? We'll have a scene where someone's supposed to go up a ladder, and you're banking so much on this working that it should have been obvious that this wasn't going to work.
It's almost cartoony. Yeah, it's almost cartoony the way that some of that stuff works.
Yes, and so, but we'll get into that scene later on. But there are elements of what Orson Welles is doing, visually speaking, that I found very fascinating. One thing I want to talk about right off the bat is when it comes to the lead female character, which is Mary. I love the fact that as the film goes on, the first time we meet Mary, she's this wholesome, sweet, kind of girl next door type look. Throughout the film, she looks more sophisticated. She looks more weary. She looks darker. In fact, the use of makeup is extremely exaggerated. She's perpetually looking dour and with like harsh lighting on her, like yep. it's trying its best to make her look darker. Her wardrobe is a lot more constraining and not as loose and flowing as it was at the beginning of the film. And especially as we get into her story, it makes sense for her, it makes sense for this visual translation, you know, or transition.
Yeah, it does a good job mirroring what's actually happening through the plot.
But I guess that brings me to my next question, which is, who is the protagonist of this film? Is it the investigator? Is it Mary? Is it Franz? I mean, what do you think?
I mean, for me, we're following Franz, I feel like. So the idea of just him kind of unraveling throughout the whole idea, or not the whole idea, throughout the whole movie, because he's getting outside pressure from that investigator, and then the whole town turns on him. I think for me, the protagonist and the one that we're following and the one whose story it is Franz's.
Okay, so normally when it comes to a protagonist, we need to see some sort of change in their character. Does Franz really change, or does his circumstance change?
I think he changes, kind of. So I think for him, it's an unraveling. So it's his true nature coming out throughout the course of the movie, which he was trying to hide so much in this small little town, and, you know, deploy his grand plot to take over America. I think that you see that. I think that a case could be made a little bit for Mary, because she does overcome and turns into a stronger character at the end, and a more independent character at the end, which I kind of liked. I don't think the investigator is the actual protagonist, because he's there just like an outside force. He's there to drive the plot along. He's not there to really make as big of an effect, and we're not following him. We're following Franz all the way through.
You know what? I definitely see what you're coming from, but I'm going to make the case that Mary is, in fact, our protagonist throughout this film. I believe that the investigator, Edward G. Robinson, is the instigator for this. His coming into town set the pieces in motion, and his dogged persistence to find Franz in this town is going to drive the other characters to do whatever they do. Franz himself doesn't really change at all. His main goal is to bring about the next war, or to be in a prime position when the next war occurs to cause the United States damage. That's his entire goal. The way he comes about that is going to have slight alterations as he tries to keep his position. And when that position becomes unsustainable, then he is trying to escape to set himself back up somewhere else in that position as well. Mary has the character arc. She goes from naive, innocent, sweet girl next door who's in love with the teacher, who, let's be honest here, just looks like red alarm should be going off on with her, like, throughout the entire movie. Like, is he the only eligible bachelor in this town? Because quite honestly, I think all the other boys that we see are either in their 50s and 60s or just reaching puberty, right? I don't think there's any other men of her age in that town, from what it looks like.
Because it looks like it was basically a college town, and you have the old folks that were there that are basically, most of them are probably parents of the kids that are going to the school.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have that big dynamic, and it looks like it's a very well-to-do little town, too.
Yes.
So when you look at it, it's probably a lot of old money. It's going to be men that are going to probably be about 18, 19, going to that college. So that age gap is really there, and she is kind of lost in the shuffle in there. Her and her brother, because her brother is kind of in limbo too. I don't think he was going to the school. So they're pretty close in age, I feel like, but they're definitely lost within that generational gap.
Yeah. And I did find it very fascinating that if it was the investigator that started this whole thing, that it would be a paper trail being done by the boys that would be the first major hurdle that Franz has to deal with, because when he murders the lieutenant, because he found out that he basically brought an investigator to his doorstep, the first thing he thinks about is strangling him. Which, let's be honest, that was like one of the most weirdest strangulations I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. It was not a very well done one at all.
Like, especially after he gives his whole speech about what he's intending to do and the rise of the Reich and all of that, which, of course, I guess Orson Welles has to have long monologues in his contract. It's like, even if they give him a character that doesn't have a long monologue, he has to find a way to turn in a long monologue. So he has to have one here. Then he strangles his boy, and then buries him under some leaves.
That was the weakest part of the whole thing. I was so upset about it.
This puts Law and Order to shame when it comes to half-buried bodies not being discovered until halfway through the movie. Right? I mean, I'm watching this and I'm just thinking to myself, I'm waiting for that donk donk sound to come up.
Right.
Seriously, this is weak. This is weak sauce for burying a body. I mean, at least do 6 feet, or not even six, maybe 3 feet. 3 feet. All right. Put some elbow grease into it. Okay.
Yeah, or at least drag him to a spot that's not populated with the dudes that are running around. You know, he just basically dragged him behind a tree and said, "Hey, hide here. I already killed you, but I need you to actually hide."
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like, I can understand with the paper trail and everything why it would be a quick rush. But I mean, come on, like middle of the night, no one's going to care. Take a shovel, do it right. I mean, because it's going to lead me to, I think, what was intended, and let's be honest here, probably the unforgivable thing that Franz does his entire movie, which is he murders a dog over this damn body. Right, I mean,
he set himself up for that though, because of what we're just talking about, and that is definitely where, you know, people don't have too much of an issue when you're killing other people, but if you kill their dog, they will turn on you with the quickness.
Well, I mean, if he didn't kill the dog, we'd want him arrested. When he killed the dog, we wanted blood. Right.
Right. Right.
And it wasn't even the killing of the dog; it's when he kicked the dog was when, like,
yeah.
And I got it, because any actor knows, you hurt an animal and you're associated with that hurting of an animal, that's going to be part of your repertoire from now on, no matter what movie you are. If Tom Hanks punched a puppy in any movie, he would be forever known as the guy who punched the puppy. Okay? That's how you don't do this. And for Orson Welles to take on this himself. And understand, we say that this is his least favorite film. Irony of ironies, this is his biggest box office was from this film. So he actually made bank on this movie. This is the only movie that made profit in a first run for any of his films.
Do you think he felt like a sellout because it wasn't his movie?
I think he understood that when he took it that it was that he was gonna, that he basically gave up a lot for this. But I think he also thought he could try to pull a Hitchcock and get away with stuff, and he didn't get away with nearly as much as he wanted. He still has, because like the scene of him burying the body was an incredibly well shot scene, right? Or I mean, not burying the body, but hiding the body. The way that it pans up and he uses this crane technique to show him moving, and especially as you're seeing the boys running around with the paper, you know, like creating the paper trail, stuff like that. That was actually an incredibly well shot out scene. The way that scene comes together.
I think everything in this movie is well shot. And I actually, watching this movie made me realize how much I like black and white, mm-hmm. because I think they do an amazing job with the use of shadows and the use of that bright, harsh light that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And everything, this film looks really great. And I like everything about it. One thing before I forget, I want to ask, we kind of mentioned this on the last one that you and I did with The Good, Bad, and the Weird, that even back then, you know, the in different countries, the animal cruelty is still kind of a thing within films. Mm-hmm. Do you think he actually kicked that dog in real life?
Absolutely not. You don't see it. You just hear it, and it's obviously a sound effect. Now, how they got that sound effect, I don't want to know.
Right.
I don't think that Orson Welles himself would have kicked a dog. I just, no matter what you say of him as an asshole to human beings, from what I understand, he's not a dog kicker. So I don't want to know how they got that sound. I don't know. I don't want to know, to be honest. It's one of those things. Like, there are certain times you just don't want to know what's in the sauce.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that, because this is in 46, and I'm just like, man, I really hope nothing actually happened to that poor dog, because I'm going to be upset. Like, already the audience is not with this guy at all after that, and that would have just made me feel worse.
I don't think that nothing, from what I understand, from everything I've heard, nothing happened to the dog. The dog was perfectly fine.
All right, good.
No dogs were harmed in the making of this movie. But I will say that you're talking about the lighting and the black and white. One thing I'm gonna have to give this movie is set design and how they created this small town on a studio backlot. How they really maximized their location the way they did. I absolutely loved the, especially when it comes to the general store. Out of curiosity, did you find yourself like really paying attention to the detail of that general store?
Not really. And that might be something that I need to go back and look at then. Because I'm looking around the whole town, and it's a gorgeous set piece, and I'm more focused, because I haven't seen a black and white movie in a long time. I think that I was more amazed by the use of the light and the shadow than anything else. So I was not paying attention to all the little details that was in that general store.
Well, believe it or not, and it was only after I had been doing research on this film that I came across this little thing. The general store actually has more importance to the story than pretty much any other location in the film. Let's look at what this general store does. The Nazi who comes to town, he leaves his bag there, right? The store itself is in the center of the town. There are things that are going to happen throughout the town that is going to come through that store. In fact, this is the store that that Franz is going to use for his alibi. This is where the investigator sets up his base of operations, is in this store. You'll notice things that are happening throughout the town through the windows of this store. In fact,
that's what I did really, really like. they're, I think near the end where they're going to the church, mm-hmm. and you can see the church and see the people entering the building through the window of the store. I really, really like that shot.
And especially like especially for someone who has seen Citizen Kane and understands how deep focus plays a large part in that movie, you know that Orson Welles loves to have as much in his frame as possible. Get as much stuff into the shot as you can. And so he has stuff in the foreground and in the background. With large windows, he's able to have something that's happening in the store and something that's happening outside the store. And you can definitely sense that. So it would make the most sense that the store would have the most detail to it, would be the most distinct location. And on top of that, if we also want to say it, it also has the most interesting supporting character, which is Mr. Potter. Mr. Potter, which for me, I'm trying not to communicate this with my feelings for another Mr. Potter that I have very strong, hateful feelings towards. Because everyone knows when you talk about Mr. Potter, you know what you're talking about.
Right.
But this Mr. Potter is a sweet, kindly old guy who apparently can't play checkers for the life of him. In fact, I'll be honest here. I was watching the checkers game that he's playing, and in every shot, the pieces are in the wrong pit and are in the wrong places.
Like, I didn't notice that. He's kicking the lieutenant's butt, the one that dies. Mm-hmm. And then it looks like the investigator played with him too, I think, right?
The investigator and Charles. Charles was using him as the alibi. So
right, and Charles is the only one that looks like he actually put up a fight against him, though.
Yes. The investigator, I think he was. They were from what it seemed like, they were trying to basically create a Sherlock Holmes aspect to this character. But the thing is that there is one scene where he actually feels like an investigator when he goes to the dinner party. And let's be honest here, I was afraid, like when Charles basically gives himself away, right? And you see that that the investigator kind of noticed it, but he doesn't say anything. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, he knows. But then he makes that phone call in the middle of the night after that really awesome smash cut, which, mm-hmm. if I'm not correct, is when he kicks the dog and he goes straight to the investigator waking up. If I'm not correct.
I believe so. Yeah. Because then I think that's when he makes the call to the brother.
He calls back to his.
Yes, he calls back to HQ saying that he's going to stay for a little bit longer.
Yeah, because he now is suspecting Charles of being the Nazi, because only a Nazi would say that that Marx is not German because he's a Jew. That's a great monologue. I'll be honest here. Of the entire film, that is possibly the most. That is the best writing was on that monologue. And you could definitely sense that was Orson Welles. Orson Welles wrote that dialogue for himself. That said, the fact that no one else caught it made me really wonder if there's some sort of commentary going on here about the obtuseness of the elite. Because, seriously, these are people that are wrapping themselves in the flag and calling themselves all kinds of American and how they're America's elite. And yet this guy basically spouts German rhetoric. And in fact, if you listen to what he tells the boys in class or the stuff that they're learning in class, all of this stuff is German propaganda.
Yeah, it's very fascist.
Yes. And so is this film making a commentary about how the rich and the elite are basically stupid? Because, you know, this guy could basically set himself up and talk this smart, you know, this kind of rhetoric, and they just accept it.
I mean, it seems like it, right? Because it feels like that they had he had free reign to do pretty much whatever he wanted. And he was an accepted member of that society all the way through. So whatever his ideals were, they were definitely being permeated throughout the entire town.
So I found it very weird how this movie played to that. And so I don't know. It's just...
I think it was a point, too, where... Because he is focusing, he set himself up to not only hit the youth, but he also set himself up to get nice and chummy with someone of very big political power, which is the Supreme Court Justice, which is Mary's dad.
Yeah. And I'll be honest here, like, it seems like the Supreme Court, that Mary's dad... does he like Charles? Does he not like Charles? There's times when it seems like he's all chummy with them, but there are other times when as soon as the investigator says he's a Nazi, he's like, oh, you're right, he's a Nazi. Like, where all these characters just flip like a switch at times. It's just kind of weird.
I think one of the things that threw me off too was that I don't think the investigator really shows any of his cards until really closer to the end of it. Now, he works with the brother hand in hand and gets the brother on his side, and that really helps the investigator to make a bigger presence. So maybe the brother was kind of flying his flag and saying, hey, you know, this is the guy that we need to listen to, because he was already suspect of Franz/Charles anyway.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest here, like, the only evidence that the investigator brings to him when they're trying to pressure Mary into accepting that Charles is, in fact, this Nazi, is they bring images of a concentration camp. Not really tying it to Charles, but just showing how awful the Nazis are. Now, I want to talk about this footage as well, because, believe it or not, this footage was actually directed by John Huston. He was actually with
the military at that point.
He was with the army when they came across a concentration camp, and he was the first American to direct footage from a concentration camp. And this is one of the things that messed John Huston up so badly that he became an even worse drunk than he already was, and possibly set him into the course that he was for the rest of his life. Understand, he wasn't exactly the most sober person before the war, but what he saw in the war messed him up pretty badly. And part of that is seeing a concentration camp. So I do want to say that this is important for that reason, if anything else.
I think also having just normal people look at that footage again and say, because I think this does two things. It in the town, it reminds them of the horror of that war. And then in the audience, too, it reminds them and gets them way more on the investigator's side and gets them to really treat Franz/Charles as this evil person, because they see the straight evidence of what he was doing in Germany.
Yeah. But the thing is that they don't really tie it to Charles. That's the thing. That's my biggest problem.
They don't have to, though. I don't think, because the investigator only has to create the spark for it. So all he has to do is start turning people against Charles/Franz, and showing that kind of atrocity on film and shocking them, because they're in a very, I think we kind of mentioned it, they're in a very isolated town where it is, you know, rich white people that are going to be very disconnected from most of the other stuff that is happening. And so for them to get kind of that that big shock of, oh, this is in my hometown. Mm-hmm. This is what he was doing overseas, and now we have to stop him. I think that's where it really goes into. And he doesn't need a lot of, because of how fresh everything is, he doesn't need a lot of evidence against him to turn the town on him.
But here's the question that I have in that regard then. If we had not known that Charles was in fact this Nazi, and we're just basically going off of the other clues that the investigator is providing, would that have been enough for you to believe that he was a Nazi?
I don't think so, and I think that kind of goes hand in hand with even the McCarthyism of when we were looking for communists. You know, you try to rile up the people and get everybody in there and get them as far as these people are so evil. If you mentioned it earlier when they were talking about how 15 minutes of this movie was taken away and they were really looking to try to make it more grounded and way more gray instead of black and white as far as who's evil and who's not. And I think that could have been a little bit more interesting, talking about how if we didn't know that he was this character, if we didn't know and we didn't see him, you know, kill and then also talk about all these other nefarious plans that he has, if it was just the investigators showing them, being like, look, this guy is a Nazi, we need this everybody to go against him, it could have been a different story. It could have been a different way that it was played out, to where it's more of a witch hunt, mm-hmm. than really an actual, hey, this guy is evil, we know he's evil because we've seen everything, now I need you guys to help me out.
I don't know. To me, I feel like that's, again, that's a conflict between Wells and what Wells, I think, was trying to do about making this a morally gray art discussion, and the black and white nature of the film that the studio wanted. You could feel the studio wanted to be clear-cut bad guys and good guys. That Charles is the bad guy because he's the evil Nazi that needs to be brought down by the investigator. By the investigator and True Blue Americans. Loretta Young's Mary. Mary is supposed to be the redeemed character, right? She doesn't want to believe that it's her, that her husband is a Nazi. No matter what the investigator says, she ignores it until she can't ignore it when it comes clear that her husband intended to kill her because she was no longer, he didn't trust that she would be on his side. And
so I don't think that they make the investigator the hero. I think they make the town the hero. I think they do a good job, like what you're talking about, True Blue Blood Americans as being the ones that are bringing this dude to justice, because you see the whole town go after him. Now, I think the most interesting part is Mary's growth and character arc throughout the whole thing, because she does become very frazzled and almost at a nervous breakdown, and you see kind of the, in that old school way of that husband knows best, right? Mm-hmm. So that pressure from the husband and the pressure, they haven't been married for more than a month when everything happens. I think it's only like a 2-week period at most that everything goes through. So she's trying to still be faithful to him and loyal to him while it's really going against her insides. And you see that where she is that nervous breakdown almost right there. And then she still has that resolve to go with him, to go to the church, to do everything and almost get set up until, what is it, her maid?
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the scene with the maid, because that was silly, right? That was like almost comedy, like almost Tyler Perry comedy levels of silly.
It was very, very outrageous, I think is a good way to put it. But it's, even with some of what Orson Welles was doing, you know, the sweat that was coming out of him and the way that everything is so heightened as far as the acting in this, and she just puts on a whole show while trying to stop her from going to the church. And it's ridiculous. I don't think that would have happened in real life. I think if I was Mary, I would have just left her there and just been like, look, you need to get your stuff together.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, how do I say this? I understand why the film does this, and I appreciate that it was kind of going for a different beat, but to me, like, there was no other comedy that kind of set up this, and I feel like it just came out of nowhere. Like
I don't think it was meant to be comedic. I think it was meant to be, you know, so dramatic that it would stop her from going. So when we look at it, it's like, why are you are doing too much? You're doing the most. You need to take it down a notch.
So you think it failed on that level, that it was aiming for something and it just missed the mark, or were you not seeing this correctly?
I think because it looks so over the top that it is so ridiculous the way that she just throws herself on the ground and be like, oh, I'm having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to anybody watching that from the outside in, I think would have been like, she's faking it. She's being ridiculous. You can just leave. But I think that inside the scene, she was trying to be serious and trying to come up with something that would definitely, you know, stop her from leaving. It wasn't executed well.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about kind of the end game for this film. We mentioned that there was a whole scene with the maid, and the reason for this is because Charles says to finally decide, okay, he's going to kill his wife, but he's going to make it look like an accident. So he tells her to go up to his clock, the clock that he was spending this entire movie to put together, and the other major clue that the investigator had was that this Nazi who had never been photographed before has an obsession for clocks. And we could talk about the clock motif in just a moment, but she's going up to this clock that he has rigged the ladder to cause her to fall. And so the nurse throws the tantrum, and so she sends her brother to go up to see to see Charles at the clock, right?
Correct. To tell him, hey, I'm going to be late coming to you. Don't tell anybody else, but you need to go let Charles/Franz know that I'm late because my maid is having a complete meltdown.
Because, you know, that makes all the sense, especially since he was talking about this super secret thing. Like, his story is the worst. Like, this is, again, almost to the point of parody, right? Like, I want you to go over to this cliff. I want you to look over the cliff. This is for a surprise that you're going to find on the others that is underneath this cliff. Like, especially considering that she, at this particular point, is almost about to suspect that he's, in fact, a Nazi. That she's almost convinced at this point. Why? Like, why? Again,
I think that. So I think you have to remember that they've been only married for a couple weeks, right? And that loyalty is still there. But I think it is very, very telegraphed. Like, the audience knows, hey, you shouldn't be don't go to that church. You're going to get killed. You're going to get murdered. Something bad is going to happen. Don't do it. So the audience knows what's going on, and the fact that she sends her brother instead, she's still thinking the better of Charles/Franz while trying to still, you know, wrestle with the fact that he could be definitely a bad dude. And that finally comes to a head when she realizes that, hey, you would have killed me if I had gone to that church and instead you could have killed my brother. Mm-hmm. And that all goes sideways for Charles real quick.
So and I'll be honest here, like when he hits that rigged ladder step or that ladder rung, it seemed like he was able to recover pretty quickly. Does that mean that he honestly thought that would have killed her? Could it have been that she could have survived that anyway?
Maybe, but it could have just been a poorly done rig. I don't know. You could see it. I just don't think that they wanted to kill off either the brother or the investigator.
I feel like that would have been a missed opportunity, especially if it were the investigator, because the investigator is the one that's instigating this. If he would have been killed in the middle of this investigation, especially under some mysterious pretenses, that would require the entire town to either come to one or two conclusions, and that would have determined the fate of the rest of the story, and that would have been more dramatic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I also think that if they would have, honestly, if the brother would have been the one that died, that would have had way more weight to it too, and would have had Mary really go after Franz as, hey, you killed my brother, I'm going to kill you now.
Well, that her ignorance has not only claimed the life of her dog, but also her brother?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. All right, so so finally, even this doesn't really convince her. It's only when she sees his plan that he stupidly put in his pocket instead of shredding it into little pieces and throwing away. Like, this is some bullshit, right?
For being like a general in the Nazi army, he's not very smart.
Well, he was more a planner than a general. But
even then, he's piss poor planning.
Yes, definitely. For the guy who was able to rig up the most atrocious genocide of all time, he has a real hard time of keeping his secrets from being discovered in his pockets. Maybe, just maybe, he just did a really good job of keeping his pockets locked up. Whenever someone's looking for it. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe they found the plans in his pockets when they raided his closet. Just saying. Just saying. But that said, his ruse has been revealed. She no longer believes him. We now have the conflict that we've been waiting for. Honestly, I think the movie was going to end here, but it doesn't. He escapes, runs off, and she passes out from, in this confrontation, right? I mean, who was it that got shot or stabbed? Or I'm trying to remember here. Or it was the investigator that got shot, wasn't it?
The investigator takes a stumble on the ladder that was meant for Mary, and that's how he gets injured.
Okay.
Because he only had the head injury and the ladder. Mm-hmm. From what I remember, what happens is Mary goes to the church.
Well,
the cemetery.
No, she passes out because she wakes up in her father's house, and they're in the process of looking for him. She knows where he is, which is where everyone should have been looking this entire time.
Yeah. Because it should have been in the church. They think that he skipped town, and that is not what happened at all. He's still in the church, just hiding and biding his time.
Even if you think he skipped town, you still check the town. My goodness. At this particular point, Tommy Lee Jones from The Fugitive would be pissed off at this movie. Come on. You know you check just in case. And especially check the place that he built rebuilt, for crying out loud.
Right.
That's his base of operations. Yep. Even the investigator should have known that one. He's like surprised. Like, I didn't realize he would go back to the clock. No, really?
Yeah, not everybody's on the same page here, and that not everybody can kind of use their brains throughout this whole thing. It makes it to where, you know, people are not smart, and that starts even with, even with Franz, that none of the stuff that he's putting in motion is really working out, because he is not the best at this at all. And that goes to the point where they're in the church, Mary gets him, he has a gun and threatens to go ahead and shoot her already, and then pulls her up, which looked really weird. I don't know what it was, but it just threw me off on it. But yeah, so pulls her up. They're talking in the church, and then next thing you know, the investigator's there, which I thought was really weird, because three or four prongs on the ladder were definitely gone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this sets up for actually what is actually one of the most tense scenes of filming, because apparently they did this for real on top of a very long drop, and the only thing keeping Loretta Young from falling to her death is a small wire that had her connected to the stuntman who was lifting her up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was a good scene where, you know, she gets the gun,
mm-hmm.
and she's the one that takes the shot, which I really, really liked.
I really liked that. But before we get to that scene, though, when she's being lifted up, like, that is a very, very, like, even without knowing that little a bit of information, like, because let's be honest here, what do we expect him to do when basically she's only hanging from his arm?
I totally thought he was going to drop her.
I did too. And again, I feel like that's where the film could have also done something very unique and very artsy. Let's be honest here. Which is, let's just say for the sake of argument, that she decides to choose her husband over her country. That she basically decides to go on the run with him. Or that she turns her back on her country and, of course, she gets shot down along with him because, you know, she's now a bad guy. That would have been pretty intense, right?
That would have been cool. I think also where we talked about before with the brother, if the brother had died going up on that ladder and she knew that it was him, and I think that would have been even cooler, to where, okay, I'm tricking you into, like, getting me close to you, and now I'm here to take revenge. I think it could have been really interesting in both ways. So for what you're talking about, where she does pick him over everything else, that would have been kind of a cool little last stand for it. But I think that if she would have had the final blow on him, I think that would have been even better.
Well, I mean, I appreciate what she did, and I love the fact that she doesn't actually kill him, but she wounds him just enough that he goes clamoring, and that he's actually murdered by his own clock.
Yeah.
And literally dies on his own sword.
I thought it was kind of silly, because those were definitely going slow, and it definitely wouldn't have gone through them. But at the same time, the irony and the justice is there, to where his own obsession and his own machine goes after him and gets the final blow on him. I thought that was actually pretty nice and pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
But and that is just, and in a way it works for what this movie is going for. But that said, I'm gonna be honest here. Especially considering that this film was actually going to be remade in a way, but made the way that I think was at least more to what Orson Welles was looking for. And that movie was going to be made out 3 years later, called The Third Man. Out of curiosity, have you ever seen The Third Man?
No, I have not. I know The Third Man Records from Jack White, but I have not heard or not seen the movie.
The Third Man is one of the first films that was shot in Berlin after the war, And so you're seeing all the wreckage and devastation of the war. But it's about this guy that is going after a noted criminal named Harry Lime. And Harry Lime is played by Orson Welles, again. But the thing is that all the suspense and tension that this film is trying to go for, but always kind of misses the mark, The Third Man did better. It sets up everything. The scenery is better. The shots are better. The photography is some of the most gorgeous in black and white. If you love black and white movies, especially black and white thrillers, The Third Man is one of the best. It's also one of the very few scores that works with a sitar outside of Bollywood.
Nice.
It's a gorgeous looking film. And you know how I know that this is that The Third Man was more of a film than The Stranger was to what Orson Welles was looking for? Because Orson Welles went so far to promote The Third Man that he actually wrote radio plays as advertisements for The Third Man. He actually created a sequel to The Third Man following Harry Lime. That's how much The Third Man was more of the movie that Welles wanted to make than The Stranger was. And Orson Welles didn't even make that movie.
Gotcha. Okay.
But I will say that said, because of the success of this film, it gives me one of the best film noirs of all time, which Orson Welles did direct, which is The Lady from Shanghai. And if you have not seen that one, oh my goodness, it's so clear that he finally got his final cut back, because that movie is bleak and stark and dark, and yeah, it is so anti The Stranger that you could almost feel like that was his middle finger to The Stranger was what Lady from Shanghai is.
I'm gonna have to check it out.
I cannot recommend it enough. And for those of you who have the Criterion channel, or need an excuse to check it out, The Lady from Shanghai and I believe The Third Man are both on the Criterion channel at this time. So go ahead and check both films out. I cannot recommend them enough. At some point, we might actually get to them. I know Lady from Shanghai is one that I've been really hoping to talk about at some point. Anyway, that said, let's get into the geek sheet right quick. We talked about Orson Welles on Citizen Kane about what he's done. Specifically, he was the voice of Unicron in the Transformers movie. I bet you didn't know that one, did you?
I did, actually. I did.
In fact, it was his last film he ever did, because before the film came out, he died.
Yep.
Also, he was, in fact, the original Le Chief from the 1960s Casino Royale. You thought that Mads Mikkelsen was the first Le Chief? Is that it?
Yeah. Yep.
Nope. Orson Welles. And let's be honest here. That Casino Royale, the one in the 60s, was a spoof of Bond films more than it was an actual Bond film. How do you know? Because David Niven, of all people, played the spy. And, of course, he had an infamous cameo in the Muppet movie, which I don't know if you've ever seen or not. But if you have not, it is a pleasant surprise to see Orson Welles as the head of a movie studio.
I'll have to watch it again. I haven't seen it in years.
But Edward G. Robinson, we did The Double Indemnity with him in it. A great film, as we discussed. For his geek creds, he was a major character in Soylent Green, which we all know. No spoilers. Batman 66, he was actually one of the villains that was on that Batman show. And as I mentioned before, he was a major villain character in many movies, specifically Key Largo with Humphrey Bogart and Little Caesar. So yeah, if you're looking for some gangster movies that have some bite to it, I cannot recommend these enough. Just a couple other things that I think are fascinating. Cinematographer was the same cinematographer from Spartacus, the Stanley Kubrick version. Which, have you ever seen Spartacus, by the way?
No. I haven't seen the old one, though.
Okay, so it is going to be, if you're familiar with the TV show, there's a serious lack of boobage.
There's no Lisa Lawless or no. Lucy Lawless in there?
No. I think Lucy Lawless was maybe minus 10 at the time.
Fair enough, yeah.
But the guy who created the score for this film, I found this fascinating when I was going through it. I just had to add it. Bronislaw Kaper, who wrote the score for The Stranger, would go on to do the score for Them, the giant ant movie. And if you've not seen Them, with an exclamation mark, you're missing out on some great, cheesy, Cold War era paranoia movies. Because what made the giant ants? Radiation.
Very cool.
And Sam Spiegel, who was the producer that was fighting Orson Welles the entire way through this film, we talked about with On the Waterfront, Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge Over Quai, which we are at some point going to talk. Have you seen either of these two films?
I've seen Lawrence of Arabia. On the Waterfront, I've seen forever ago. Bridge Over the River Kwai, I have not seen. That's the only one.
Okay, then at that point, we're going to make that an excuse to do that episode. If anything else, Alec Guinness, Academy Award winning role, you've got to see it. Obi-Wan does his best acting in that movie. Anyway, so with the geek shit out of the way, Chris, do you agree with the critics on The Stranger? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe?
I give it a maybe. It looks nice. The lighting is amazing. The use of shadow and the use of light, I think, is something that if you aren't used to black and white, I think will drive you into seeing more of that. That's definitely what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be looking at a lot of the older films, the black and white films, because this made me really love all the different shots, the close-up shots, the going through the different rooms, the different windows. I really liked just everything cinematography-wise. The acting, I'm not sold on. Orson Welles as an actor, and even some of the other actors that are through here, they just do so much. And it is very hammy, in my opinion. So I think if you want, and this film goes by quick. So if you want just to kill an hour and a half and see some really nice stuff and really get kind of hooked into the idea of black and white movies again, go for it. But overall, you could probably skip it.
All right, so in that on my end, I'm just going to say that I kind of like this movie to the extent that it does have some pretty awesome scenes. But that said, though, as I mentioned before, even Orson Welles doesn't feel like he's giving his best work here, and there's so many holes in this movie. There are so many places where it just doesn't work. And characters make so many stupid decisions. And it's just enough that none of the good stuff in this movie can just overcome it. Like I said, I mean, this is a movie that was made better with The Third Man. Orson Welles made a much better film the next time around with the lady from Shanghai. This is, I can understand, I mean, it was by accident that this film got knocked into, I forgot the term where no one holds the copyrights anymore. Public domain.
Public domain, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it was an accident that this movie got into public domain, but at the same time, though, who really is going to make any money off of this? This is not a good movie. This is not something that should be on a Criterion list or This is a side piece to Orson Welles' work, and one that I think even he wishes he could just forget. But I will say that it has some interesting elements to it, so you could watch it for that. But I can't even in good conscience maybe it. This is weird. This is a fail. Possibly the only fail I'll ever give an Orson Welles film. I mean, I haven't seen Chimes from Midnight yet, so maybe I might do that, but I seriously doubt it. But yeah, this is an absolute fail. But that said, I think we're ready to go ahead and close the page on this particular episode. Chris, where can people find you on the internet?
You guys can find me on my own podcast called Ambition Radio, where I interview people who have found some kind of balance between their life, family, career, and the pursuit of their passions, dreams, or hobbies. I'm on the Facebooks, I'm on the Instagram, so come find me and then we can chit-chat over there.
And if you're looking for any other extra goodness from Art House Legends podcast, you can do so by going onto our Facebook page or on Twitter at Art House Legends. We're also on Spotify. We're on iHeartRadio. We have our site that you can go on to and check us out there. And if you are feeling up to it, go on to iTunes, give us a 5-star review, or if you want to go on to any of your other podcasts and give a glowing review there, you can do so as well. If you want to email me with your questions or suggestions, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and I will get back to you shortly. Chris, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is Movie Dude Eric.
This is Chris Donable.
And Fiend.